ready to go. Welcome all. Good to see many faces that are familiar. And thanks again, and being that this is the last night that we're going to be learning together, at least within this particular series, we thank Rabbi Kelman and Rabbi Shalom for all the efforts they've to make this dream into reality. It's a fabulous program. I love doing this, and it's a big plus to be involved in this exciting, pioneering Torah venture. We're going to speak about tonight a very, very a vitally important issue, one which is so incredibly important to maintaining family harmony and maintaining Torah values, and that is estate planning and halacha. Our focus tonight is going to be a little different than some of the discussions we've had in the last 5 weeks, which have been pretty technical. This time we're going to be focused on a little bit more broad perspectives, and then we'll start speaking about some of the technicalities about how precisely one would go about enabling non-halachic heirs to receive a full share in an estate. Let's begin as follows. When we think of estate planning, we think that all is involved is transferring assets to the next generation in a manner that minimizes taxes, and that the step that we need to take is hire a sharp attorney who can achieve this goal. And we think of Jewish estate planning as something that we think of clever ways of how to sidestep the Torah laws regarding women not receiving a share in most cases, wives not receiving a share, daughters, and the firstborn receiving a double share, how we can avoid that. Well, we're going to discuss that tonight. I think we're going to discuss some of the basic points of what an estate plan that's in harmony with halacha, what would that look like? So we're going to begin with the basic outline, and then we're going to go to some details. First, it's about establishing peace, working how to establish shalom bayis within the family. Number two, it's about avoiding revenge. It's about honesty. It's about tzedakah. It's about trust. It's about living wills and healthcare proxies. It's about meeting obligations to parents and in-laws. And about ethical wills, and then we'll get into some of the technical solutions regarding manners in which women can get a share in an estate. Let's begin talking about establishing peace. We could take a look in the source sheet that you have available. Source number one is an incredibly important piece of the Rambam writes. Rambam in the context of Hilchos Yerusha breaks from discussing the technical laws of Yerusha and gives us an exhortation, tells us that Chazal teach us not to favor one child over another, even in the slightest manner, in order that the children not be jealous of one another, such as Yosef's brother were with Yosef. And the Rambam is teaching us an incredible lesson, and that is that parents and teachers need to know that they have to go take proactive steps to make sure that whatever they do does not arouse any jealousy, that all children, all students should be treated equally. And this especially applies in an estate because When a child will receive less in a will than another child, this can cause and has caused, unfortunately, profound rifts within families to the point that you can have siblings not speaking each other, uneven distribution of an estate. And I'd like to just share with you a psychological insight that I believe in based on my experience as a father of four and of a teacher of hundreds. And that is that students, and especially children, are very, very sensitive and almost have an antenna out. They're very worried about the parents' love. They're concerned, do our parents love us? And do the parents favor one child over another child? And as soon as there's a sense that a parent loves one child over another, that can cause profound hurt because it communicates a very painful message to the child that the parent doesn't love them completely. And that's very hurtful. And if in a will, this idea is communicated very concretely. The parent gives more money to one child more than another child. This can cause profound anger and jealousy to the point that people can be lost from their family members can be angry at each other literally for years. Now, just to address that, Judah is asking the right question, and that is the Rambam referring only to boys? It's even girls. Well, I'll be honest. The Rambam is speaking purely about boys. He isn't addressing girls. In the Rambam's time, sons would be the ones who would inherit, and not the daughters. Today, right, before, right, today, this is not the case. Today, daughters expect to have a full share, and what I'm going to stress at the end of this year, as Herschel Schefter has stated to me, and has stated to others as well, that today, daughters have to receive a full share in the will. And if they don't, then this can cause rifts in the family. I've seen other Rabbanim as well. I've seen even a suggestion among some Rabbanim today that maybe a minimal, nominal part of the will should be distributed according to the Torah laws of boys getting the shares and the double share for the Bechor. But others have objected to it, saying that any even tiny show of favoritism to one child over another can cause profound disturbance to Shalom Bayis. And therefore, today, in the circumstances today, there has to be absolute equality. Now, in terms of establishing peace and working hard to establish peace, it's incredibly important when one's establishing drafting a will that one... Okay, that begs the question. Why did the Torah not have a... Okay, that's a good question. All right, before I move on, I'm going to try to address... Rabbi Kelman's issue about why the Torah did not have equality in the inheritance of the estate. All right, that's a huge question, and Rabbi Kelman usually catches me on the points that I was trying to avoid, but that's keeping me honest. Very good. I'll tell you some thoughts I have about this. It's a little bit speculative. I think that in the time of the Torah, it was expected that husbands would be providing would be taking care of the financial needs of the wives, and the daughters would not need to receive a share in the inheritance because they would be taken care of by their fathers or by their husbands. And this, in the pre-modern age, it was not necessary for daughters to receive a share in the estate. But today, I'll get to Tzlafchad in a second. Today, the circumstances are that, for better or for worse, women are expected to contribute to the economic well-being of the family, and therefore they do need the money, and it's important that they do get a share in the Yerusha. I mean, the truth be told, we'll take a look in the handout, in source number 9, we're going to get to about one child with very large income and greatest... Okay, I'll get to the two... To the question, that's an important question that was raised just now. A couple of questions, we'll just do it one at a time. that that we would we lost my train of thought looking at the question. So today, since daughters are expected to participate in economically, it's important they receive a share in the Yerusha, a full share. And this is actually Ashkenazic Jews have been practicing for hundreds of years that daughters receive a share in the estate. How they accomplish that, we'll get to a little bit later. We'll see that in source number 9. This has been going on at least since the time of the Ramah in the 16th century. Okay, Benot Slavchad. That's a good question from Judah about Benot Slavchad. Benot Slavchad does give us some leeway. There, it seems that the motivation for the Benot Slavchad was not that they were that they needed the field of their father for economics, but the concern of the Benot Slavchad was preserving the family estate for their father. And the Benot Slavchad, it seemed fairly clear, they were more than happy for their sons to inherit them. I don't think they were trying to make a profound change in the system, but I think they were looking out for their father's benefit, because the way one achieves eternity in Torah life was their land was passed down to generation to generation, and the Benot Slavchad wanted to preserve their father's link to eternity by having his land passed on from generation to generation. If you want to take a further, for an excellent discussion of the Benot Slavchad, you could take a look in, there's an excellent teacher of Tanakh today in Israel. His name is Rav Elchanan Tzanit. There's an excellent article regarding the Benot Slavchad saying with the Benot Slavchad, the daughters of Slavchad, were they early feminists? And that article is available at the virtual Beit Midrash of Shivat Haratzion, a fascinating topic. Okay, now what happens, the question's been asked by Aubrey and Barbara and Chuck. What happens if one child has a very large income and great assets, the other has smaller income and lesser assets? Okay, that's a very, that's a tough question. And I know I've been saying that it has to be equality. What if one child has greater economic needs than the other? So I would say as follows. I could tell you of stories that have happened where a child was left the money in the will, and because that child needed money, and another child wasn't left money because at the time that the will was drafted, that person was well off financially. Well, these things tend to change. And what's happened is the child who was well off financially lost his wealth and needed the money, the same as the other child, and then it caused great friction. So it's not so simple that to say to leave more money in the will to the child that has lesser estates, has lesser assets. It's not a simple question. It's not a simple solution. Another solution might be. Is that what has been suggested is that one would give lifetime gifts to the child who has smaller assets, smaller income, lesser assets, greater needs. That should be given during the lifetime of the parent. The will would be the same, but the gift would be from the parent during the lifetime. A third suggestion could be is if there's going to be any disparity in the will, there should be a letter, a side letter, which would explain to the children why the parents are giving more to one child than another, and the parents will reassure that they love each child equally. What about grandchildren? That's an important, right, that's a very, very important question. Does that play a part? What if there are more grandchildren from one child than from another child? I still think that it's important that there should be equality to all the children, even if there are one child, particular child has more grandchildren. You're asking a very good question. And these are very custom tailored to a particular family's need, and everyone should consult with their rabbi about this. The most important thing to get out of this part of our discussion is that one should not take 5 minutes or even an hour to draft their will. Has to be thought out very, very well. I just wanted to give one example. in the tshuva literature where we a case which highlights the lack of proper preparing and forethought in drafting a will. And it's a case that's dealt with by Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, the late author of the Tzitz Eliezer, where he adjudicated the following case. Man left a will, and he left as follows. He said that all his assets should be shared by his male and female children. However, the male children would receive all the svarim. Okay, that's what he did. But the problem was, in the estate, there was included a number of very old and very valuable manuscripts. So the question is, should those manuscripts be shared amongst all the children, even the daughters? Is it considered as an asset that should be shared by all the children? Or are those technically defined as svarim? Because technically speaking, they are svarim, but do we say that they are considered to be an asset rather than svarim? Without discussing how Rav Waldenberg resolved this question, more important than that is the lesson that we learned from this was that this whole din Torah, this whole adjudication could have been avoided had the father thought out, when he made his draft of his will, thought out his estate a little bit more clearly, so to avoid the need for this dispute. And also we can learn from this, if there's a dispute, it should be brought to a Rav for adjudication. Okay, let's talk about now the next part of an estate plan, a Torah estate plan, and that is avoiding revenge. Take a look in source number 10, the Gemara Bava Basra on Kufla Megillah Mezeis writes that it's wrong to disinherit a rightful heir, even from a bad son to a good son. And so, in other words, it's saying that it's quite a drastic step for a parent to give to disinherit a child, and one has to think very, very long and hard before they would even consider doing this, because the halacha is so strongly discourages disinheriting a child. The question is that are there any circumstances where it would be acceptable? The rights of Moshe Feinstein in the Tshuva that one could disinherit a very bad son. Well, what would be a very bad son? A very bad child could be an example of example would be if a child has intermarried. That I think we could agree that would be a very bad child. It would be good cause for disinheritance. The only thing is that this may not work at least in the United States. If the will is challenged, it may not work. And not only that, if the child is really so interested in receiving the share in the will, if they've intermarried, the spouse can go to quite a number of rabbis, unfortunately, that are available to do subpar conversions, would go through a pro forma conversion, and they would go to the court and claim that they're Jewish, and that the child has not intermarried, and therefore should be entitled to a full share in the will. And then the civil court would have to decide who is a Jew, whether the non-Jewish spouse, whether they actually the conversion is a valid conversion, not conversion, not invalid conversion. That's something that has no place in the civil courts. They don't want it there. We don't want it there. And therefore, it may not make sense to disinherit even a child that's intermarried. But instead, what to do, a better strategy, is to follow the advice, a modification of an advice from Rav Avad Yosef in one of his tshuvos. Rav Avad Yosef writes, in such a case, what one should do is take a friend that he trusts and leave the money in the will to this friend and tell this friend to disperse funds that will encourage the very bad child to take steps in the Torah direction, such as the money could be used for Torah education, for summer camps, for visits to Israel. This so suggests Rav Avadja Yosef. And the analog here in North America would be appropriate, perhaps, in certain cases to establish a trust and set aside money that the intermarried child or the intermarried child's children could use. The money could be set aside for them to use for activities which will encourage a Jewish identity, and that money can be set aside, use it or lose it. Either use it for something Jewish, or the money would go to charity, right? Or day school, right? So it's to send them to a day school, exactly. Send them to chat if they're in Toronto. This would encourage the intermarried child or the estranged child to send their children to a yeshiva, because this is the only way they'll get the money. So the idea is not to disinherit them, but to have the money that would go to them to be used only if it's directed towards promoting activities that will promote a Jewish identity. Okay, let's now go to sources number 2 and 3. And this is that stucco should be an important part of a will, and that many rabbis have encouraged that 10% of tzedakah of one's will should go to charity. And it's important that besides giving the tzedakah, which has two aims. First of all, that it will help assure one to have a share in Olam Haba. There's an important story that the Gemara Ksubos on Daf Some of Zion Amid Beis relates about Mar Ukva, who was very generous and stuck in his lifetime, and before he died, he donated half of his estate to Tzedakah, because he says he has a very long journey and very few provisions. So the Tzedakah would be his provisions in order to share, to ensure that he has a proper share in Olam Haba. So that's one point of what Tzedakah accomplishes in a will. And secondly, it sets a good example for the next generation to give tzedakah in following the example. And in Parshas Vayero, it says that Hashem chose Avraham Avinu, ki dativ l'man asher tzavos banav v'tzbeisa acharav l'asos tzedakah o'mishpat. Okay, can tzedakah be given to a school? That example would benefit his grandchildren. My overall opinion is yes. To my mind, one of the most critical problems that North American Jewry are facing, perhaps more in America than in Canada, is that day school education is becoming more and more prohibitive and becoming very expensive. And if money in a will can be directed towards ameliorating and mitigating this problem and making day school education more affordable, I think the more money that would go to Jewish education, the better that would be. That's, I think, a very important. It's a struggle for Jews here in America to Jews in North America to be able to survive culturally. So we need to be able to afford our day schools. Okay. Most Chosen say one should give more than 10%. I think most Chosen would say that one should give 10%. 20% is a limit, right? 10% is a limit of a lot, depending on the one text in Ksuba's Zamos Zayim Beis. It would be 50 or 33% limit, but that may be limited for people with large estates. But 10% would be for most estates. Okay, so actually, just wanted to return just for one moment, just about establishing peace, and then we'll start talking briefly about living wills and healthcare proxies. So also, on just one point to clarify in terms of Tanakh sources, in terms of clarity in one's will. Take a look in source number 4. Is the Sefer Bereishit in the Parashat Chayisar describes that Avraham gave everything he had to Yitzchak. And he gave the Pilakshim, he gave gifts, and he sent them away from Yitzchak during Avraham's lifetime. That's very, very important, that one should establish during one's lifetime to take pains to be clear about one's estate. Because what explains the Malbim, why did Avraham establish Why did Avram give the gifts and divide his assets amongst Yitzchak and his other children during his lifetime? Because Avram wanted to make it absolutely clear that the bris, that the bracha, will go to Yitzchak and not the other children. And he wanted to avoid a debate during his lifetime. And I should add, I could ask, from whom did Avraham learn this? Who did Avraham learn that it's very important to establish who is going to be the child that's going to be his successor during his lifetime? It would seem that he learned that from Sarah Imenu. Sarah Imenu was the one that was insistent that Yishmael's status should be clarified while Avraham is still alive, and should not be left until Avram dies, so there should be a dispute between between Yitzchak and Yishmael as to who is the authentic successor to the legacy of Avraham and Sarah. And if you want to see more about this particular issue, again, I'm going to refer to Rabbi Chanan Samet in his discussion of Parshas Vayera, of why Yishmael was sent away at age 16, 17. And he basically tries to explain how it was important for Avram to clarify that Yishmael was not the son that was going to be succeeding him. Okay, now let's go talk briefly about living wills and healthcare proxies. This is incredibly important on a number of levels. First of all, by establishing a healthcare proxy, one ensures that one's wishes will be honored by the hospital by the one who's taking care of you medically, one's healthcare providers, because without the protection of a healthcare proxy, very often, unfortunately, at least I've heard stories that hospitals pressure patients' families to act in ways that are not always in harmony with halakha. A healthcare proxy will ensure that one is legally entitled to to follow halakha in regards to end-of-life issues. And it's also a very important instrument to help maintain shalom bayis. Let me try to illustrate this in the following point. In terms of end-of-life issues, you have two huge issues that are raging within the halacha community. Number one, you have the question regarding transplants. Are transplants, are they acceptable according to the halacha, or are they not acceptable? Most poskim will allow a cornea transplant, skin transplants, but the most controversial transplants are heart, liver, and lung. And this all hinges upon the famous issue regarding brain death. What does the halakha believe regarding brain death? This is not a clear issue at all. It's a hotly debated issue. And this can cause profound rifts amongst family members. And I'll just try to illustrate. If, God forbid, there was an accident, and family members could be arguing about, can we donate organs? Can we not donate organs? And one family member will say, let's go to Rabbi X to resolve the question. And then the other family member will say, well, Rabbi X is, we don't trust Rabbi X, let's go to Rabbi Y. And these issues do come up within a family. When a parent will set aside and make it absolutely clear who is going to be the health proxy, who is going to decide these matters, this helps avoid the lack of clarity and avoid these fights, because this way you have a means, you have a roadmap how disputes will be resolved. The father or the mother has set aside which rabbi or which child, which trusted friend will be the one who will resolve any question regarding healthcare towards end of life. Now healthcare proxy is not enough. Just by designating a proxy to make healthcare decisions for you in a case you cannot, that is insufficient, because it does not address the second of the most controversial issues in halacha today, and that is the question of how vigorous should one be treating a patient who is near death? Should one be fighting for the last breath? Should one, let's say, if you have a patient who is comatose for 2 years and now is experiencing a heart attack, should one revive them? Should one intubate a patient who's been in a coma for 2 years? Is there any point to doing that? Well, some Rabbanim say that this should be done. This is the argument, I believe, Rav Elyashiv, who believes, Tzitzel Yezza seems to believe this, Rabbi Black certainly believes this, Rav Fivel Cohen from Brooklyn, that one should be fighting for the last breath aggressively. Rav Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, however, don't believe that. They believe that in certain circumstances, certain limited circumstances, it's appropriate to withhold certain extraordinary medical care, such as a respirator or recovery from a heart attack, for patients who are in, let's say, a vegetative state or experiencing a tremendous amount of pain, and there's no hope for a cure. By intubating the person, one is merely prolonging an agonizing situation for which there is no possible resolution. That Rosh Hashanah Zalman Auerbach believe that it's mutter to withhold the care in that case. But they believe that one can withhold these extraordinary care. Again, I just want to explain, they believe you should provide food and water. But these authorities believe that you can withhold the extraordinary care only if this was the desire and the will of the patient. If the parent made it clear that this is what their attitude is, they do not want to be fighting for the last breath in a desperate situation, then one is permitted to withhold some extraordinary treatment. That's why a healthcare proxy alone is inadequate, because it's important to fill out, maybe not a living will, it's hard to find a living will that's in harmony with halacha, but it's important to inform the healthcare proxy, both in writing and orally, to explain to them what's one's attitude towards these issues. Does one believe that one should fight for the last breath? One does not believe that. This should be made clear to the healthcare proxy. So the healthcare proxy should be supplemented with, I believe, an informal letter to the healthcare proxy, and also a discussion with family members, their attitude is. Towards withholding extraordinary medical treatment in a desperate situation. Okay, Rabbi Kellerman says, doesn't the RCA have a living will on its website? Okay, that was another issue. I didn't want to, a controversial issue I was trying to dodge, but it's good that you're keeping me honest again. The answer to that is that although I'm on the halacha committee of the RCA, that's okay. No, it's good. It's good. You're keeping me honest. The living will on the RCA website, I'm not a fan of. I don't advocate it. And the RCA halacha committee at this point is in serious deliberations regarding organ transplants, and also about the RCA living will, which assumes that brain death is a halachically acceptable definition of death, which is a hugely controversial issue. Okay, any other questions about a healthcare proxy and living wills? Okay, all right. Let's talk about one last point. We'll talk about ethical wills, and then we will talk a bit. Then we'll start getting into the fancy footwork regarding enabling non-halachic shares to receive a full share in the will. Ethical wills. The last thing that the last thing that a child hears from a parent should not be, how to distribute monetary assets in the estate. This would be, this I believe sends a counterproductive message to the children. It's basically saying to the children, what matters to us is money, or that's the only thing that matters to us, and Torah values, if they're not mentioned at all, and the love the parent has for the child, if that's not mentioned at all in the will, leaves a child feeling pretty empty, and it would be much more fulfilling for a child if the will should not only discuss the disbursement of the assets within the estate, but also should have an ethical will. One of the great halachic poskim of the mid-20th century, Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky, writes in his classic work, The Echad Gesher HaChaim, that everyone in their will should include an ethical will, which should give a vision for children and grandchildren what one's view is and how one should conduct a Torah life. And if you would like to see examples of ethical wills, there are some interesting books on ethical wills of various prominent Jewish personalities over the last 100 years, or even earlier and before that. But I would add that one does not necessarily have to look to these recently published books that collect ethical wills, but the Tanakh itself has many ethical wills. I'll just cite two, for example. Moshe Rabbeinu has an ethical will that's basically Sefer Dvarim, is Moshe Rabbeinu's ethical will to Klal Yisrael, charges them with a mission to conquer Eretz Yisrael and how to accomplish that goal and adhere to the laws and spirit of the Torah. That's basically the Sefer Dvarim in a nutshell. And Yosef also presents an ethical will, a lot shorter than Moshe Rabbeinu's ethical will in Sefer Dvarim. Yosef's ethical will, towards the end of Sefer Bereishit, is one line. It's an incredible event. Yosef gathers all the Jews in Mitzrayim. He's about to die. He's been the Mishloach Melech. He's been the second of the kings for 80 years. And he gathers them, and he makes a very, very short speech. He says, even shorter than the Gettysburg Address, Elokim pakol yivkod etchen, v'avalitim atzmotayim yizeh. Tells him two things. Hashem's going to take you out of Egypt, and when you take me, and when you leave Egypt, make sure to take my bones out of here with you, and we're living comfortably in Mitzrayim for about 71 years. And he said to them that, yes, I've been the Mishloach Melech for 80 years, but you should understand something. And that is, I still don't view myself as an Egyptian, and you too should not view yourself as an Egyptian. The day is going to come, we're going to leave. That is a very short, very succinct message that Yosef transmitted to Bnei Yisrael, but it was a very powerful message, the one that really saved the Jewish people and preserved their Jewish identity. So an ethical will can be as long as Sefer Dvarim, it can be as short as one pasuk, as long as one accomplishes what one needs to accomplish in regarding an ethical will. Okay, now let's go we'll spend the last 20 minutes of the shiur about daughters receiving a share in the will. Now, what's done? Let's first begin by what's done today in Israel, and how we can accomplish something in a similar manner in this country. In Israel, what's done is as follows: what the rabbis and the rabbinic courts, what the Batei Din do is, they say that they'll call the halachic heirs into Beis Din, and they'll ask the halachic heirs to transfer by means of a kinyan sudar, a halachic symbolic act of acquisition, that to transfer title to of the halachic heirs of the money that they've inherited to the non-halachic heirs that are named in the will. So, for example, if the daughters are given a full share in the will along with the sons are asked to gift the money to the daughters. Now, let me try. I'll give you an example how this would work on the American scene. I don't necessarily recommend doing this, but this is how I handle things in my family. Unfortunately, I lost my parents, both of my parents, and I realized that, and my parents provided in their will that there should be a full a sharing between brother and sister. And I realized one day that, and they didn't take any extra halachic provisions to make sure that this would be in harmony with halacha. So I realized we have a really big problem in my family in this regard, and that is that my sister has this money that halachically she's not entitled to. And basically that money that she has in her hands would halachically be considered as theft, believe it or not, as gezel, because that's money that she's entitled to by civil law but not by halacha. So how did I solve this problem? I solved the problem very simply. My sister happened to be visiting me on that day, and what I did was I asked my sister, give me a pen, and we'll execute a kinyan sudar, a symbolic means of transferring title to an item, such as you see it at a wedding, at a ksuba, you'll see, and many of us will see soon, by the selling of chametz. I'm going to talk about that. This would be the easiest way to avoid this problem. Let the will accomplish what it needs to accomplish, and then the halachic heirs would gift the money that the daughters received in the will to the daughters. Let's say if the daughters have inherited, for argument's sake, $100,000, and the son got $100,000. The son should say, look, halachically, I own that $100,000 that you have, but I'm gifting that $100,000 to you. This is what I did in my family. I've recommended others to do as well. In families where peace reigns, that could work very, very well. Now, interesting. So Rabbi Kelman asks, can you rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein? Rav Moshe Feinstein does have a tshuva that Dina Malchus Adina works for secular will. That we have a rule in halacha that Dina Malchus Adina, that halacha recognizes for certain matters the rules of the civil law. So Rav Moshe argues that the transfer that I made to my sister was already accomplished by the civil law. But almost all the Rabbanim disagree with that point. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, although Rav Moshe is undoubtedly the greatest of the postgame of the 20th century, but nevertheless, almost virtually all the postgame in the 20th century that I'm aware of disagree with Rav Moshe, and they believe that Dina Malchus Adina would not be a means to transfer the money from the halachic wills to the non-halachic wills. Okay, what if they don't want to? Should from sister give the money to non-from brother if it is really gezel? Okay, that's another hard question to ask. I would say as follows, and you take a look in source number 7. It's two very, very important sources. There's a very important Gemara in Gittin that says, mitzvah l'kayim divrei ames, we must have mitzvah to honor the wishes of the dead. Now, technically, that does not obligate us to the son to give the money to the daughter in the way that I did, because the Shulchan Aruch follows the ruling of Rabbeinu Tam, we have in source number 8, that this rule of mitzvah kind of divrei ames only applies if the money was deposited in the hands of a third party. An IRA probably would qualify as money deposited in the hands of a third party. But most of the money in a state is not deposited. No sound? It's like, do you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you confirm?
Do you hear
me?
I hear you.
You can hear me now. Okay, good. We hear you. Okay, great. Great, Judah. We're technically speaking, the rule of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Ames does not obligate the sons to to honor the secular will. However, it's an ethical obligation, and as Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky put it, it is hider mitzvah kibud av v'aim. It's a proper way for one to fulfill the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, even technically one is not obligated to do so. The proper thing is to follow the rule of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes. So if your question is, should the frum sister give the money to the non-frum daughter if it's really gezel, I would say that the proper thing is that the daughters, I'm sorry, that the brother should give to the sister. Oh, I see what you're saying. Should a frum sister give the money to a non-frum brother? Oh, okay. Well, okay. That's a good question. My answer to that could be, if a non-frum brother is not willing to effect the transfer, then you could rely on Rav Moshe, and you could also rely on a ruling of the Binyan Sion that holds that the rule of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes applies even if the money has not been deposited in the hands of a third party. Okay? I've asked Rav Feivel Cohen from Brooklyn, a major posek who has devoted much time to, and wrote a sefer about inheritance and halacha. He writes that an IRA, and life insurance policy probably as well, but an IRA is money which is deposited in the hands of a third party. He said that about an IRA specifically. I would imagine it applies to life insurance. That should be no problem. I see what you're saying. Oh, so Judah's saying that the IRA and the life insurance should go to, which is third party, right? If this is the sister and the other ass to the son, if they equalize. Okay, that's a good point. That is a good idea. The only thing being practically, you have to speak to an attorney. It may not work out so well because it's hard to figure out in advance what monies the son would receive after tax. The IRA, you know what it would be. The life insurance, you know what it would be. But the money in the will, the sons may actually wind up getting less than the daughters because more money may be given in taxes than one may expect. So the after-tax gift to the son may not be the same as what the daughters receive, and therefore that could lead to rifts. So your idea, while it's a good one, Judah, it may not be so practical to avoid avoid tension and fights between siblings. Rabbi Kelman, thank you. An IRA is similar to an RRSP. Thank you for translating into Canadian for us. Okay, good. Thank you very much. Any more questions about about what we've done, and then we'll talk about what's a common way, and probably the manner that I would advise most people to how to accomplish daughters or wives receiving a share in the will. Okay, ready to move ahead? All right. Let's take a look in source number 9. Source number 9 describes the following situation. This is very common practice amongst Ashkenazic Jews for hundreds of years. We don't do it anymore, but this is what's done. Well, I'll read to you the Ramah. The Ramah writes up, and then I'll explain it. So our practice today is to write a note of obligation to one's daughter and stipulate that if Allah cares, we'll give the daughter half a share of one of the sons in the estate, and the debt will be forgiven. This is what was known for generations as a shtar, a document that will entitle a daughter to a half a share in the will. Now, there was variations of it called the shtar zachar shalom. The Ksos speaks of that in Chosh Mishpat Sivan Lama Gimel, that the sons could receive a full share in the will. And in fact, we have one of these documents, believe it or not, that Rebbe Kiva Eger wrote for his own daughter. A shtar zachar shalom that Rebbe Kiva Eger's daughter, who's remarrying the Chassam Sofer, should receive a full share in the will. So if we said this is good enough for the Chassam Sofer and Rebbe Kiva Eger, it's good enough for us as well. And today, as Rav Schechter said, daughters should receive a full share in the will. Now, what is the idea here? Well, we'd be done as follows. At the wedding, this was a form of nadin, this was a form of nadunya, of a dowry given to the daughter. The father would say, would give the following document to the daughter. It says, you, daughter, I owe a huge amount of money, a sum far larger than the expected amount of the the expected value of the estate. So let's say the estate would be worth $2 million. The debt to the daughter would be established for $5 million. And this obligation would take effect an hour before death. And then there would be a stipulation made that the halachic heirs will give the daughter half a share in the will or a full share in the will. Then the debt will be forgiven. So the idea as follows is that this conditional debt, the shtar hadizachar, basically motivates the halachic heirs to gift their share in the will to the gift the daughter's portion of the will to the daughters or to the wives. Because if the halachic heirs do not give this gift, then they would be stuck with this huge obligation, which would be far larger that they would inherit and would obligate them far more than they would actually receive if they were to take their full share in the will and not share with their daughter. So it's a very brilliant idea that the Ramah has, and I don't know if the Ramah originated. It seems to be recording a practice that Jews have for many, many generations that will motivate the sons to give a full share in the will or half a share in the will to the daughters. Now, what would be a modern analog of this shtar hadizachar? We don't practice this anymore. We don't do this at a wedding, but this is what we do. When my wife and I made a will. We did was as follows: we went to the lawyer and we drafted a will, all in accordance with the civil laws. And my daughters receive a share, half full share with the son. God forbid, after 120, and if I predecease my wife, then she inherits everything. How do I accomplish that? I accomplish that by as follows. I had the will is taken care of by the attorney. And then we had a separate document of obligation where I say as follows, that I write a note of obligation to one of my daughters for a huge amount of money, far greater than the anticipated value of the estate. And at that point, after 120 years, the halachic heirs are given the following choice. I'm sorry, again. I establish this huge obligation to my daughter. It takes effect an hour before death. And a stipulation, a tenai is made that this debt is forgiven if the halachic heirs honor the provisions of the will, which give the daughters a full share in the estate. So basically, it's say this is presenting to the halachic heirs the following: either honor the dictates of the will, or if you don't honor, which means basically gifting the money that you've received in the will to the daughters or to the wife, or if you don't do this, then you're going to be saddled with a huge debt. This would be the modern analog to the shtar chatzi zachar. And as I said earlier, it's important that in certain cases can be exceptional, but in most cases, or almost all cases. To Vizman is that the daughters should share fully in the will and the way to accomplish the daughters receiving a full share in the will and not violate halacha is to have this to execute this modern analog of the shtar chatzi zachar. That's the idea, and that shtar would be kept in the hands of the rabbi. And that document never has to be produced. It would only have to be produced if the sons would take the daughters to a basin and say the sons will say to the daughters, look, you daughters, you have no right in the estate, even though the will provides for it, it's against halacha. What you receive in the estate is theft in your hands, you have to give it to us. So the defense of the daughters would have to do is they'd have to produce that shtar chati zachar, and they, or the modern analog of the shtar chati zachar, presented the basin and say, okay, they demand that we give to them the money we've received in the will. Well, that's the case. Now we are going to demand that the halachic heirs pay this obligation the father has taken upon himself. So this shtar chati zachar basically has no place in the civil court. It has its place only in a basin. And a civil court, it potentially could be a problem, could be construed as gift tax. So it should be something that should be kept independent of the civil court. Now, good. Is a copy of such a will readily available? The answer is yes. Readily available. You can download it from the Rabbinical Council of America website. The name of that website is rabbis.org. You can take a look right on the front page. They tell you how to execute a halachic supplement to a secular will. Again, you have a secular will. You have the supplement of this note of obligation to a daughter or to another non-halachic heir. And yeah, you write this conditional obligation. And that document is kept in the hands of the rabbi to be produced only if the son's challenge the basin the son's challenge the validity of the daughter's receiving a share in the Yerusha as provided for in the will. Okay, and that should work in all countries as it is actually separate from the will. Right, unlike our discussion of a good couple of weeks ago regarding the prenuptial agreement, whether it works in Canada, this should work in all countries because this stuff is separate from the will. It's nothing to do with the civil laws. The halacha is the same in the United States and in Canada. And this shtar chati zachar should be no difference between whether it's done in Canada, Montreal, or New York, or Passaic, or any other foreign locale. Okay, now you should know that the various formulations of this modern analog, I'm aware of at least six very different variations, and there's some variations that are much longer than Rabbi Willig's document that appears on the RCA website that Rabbi Willig formulated, but that's the one that I recommend. It's very simple to do. It's about a third of a page long. It's very simple to execute. You can bring it to your rabbi and execute it. I execute them every once in a while. Literally takes no more than 5 minutes to execute, and it ensures that the next generation has their money in a manner that is kosher and not in violation of halacha. Okay. Why can't you divide your savings for your children 1 hour before death in accordance with the will? That's a good question that Aubrey, Barbara, and Chuck are asking. Right, that's a very good question. Why can't you divide your will? So the answer to that is as follows. Halakhically, that would be acceptable. That is a good, one could do that. The only thing is that it may not be practical to do it 1 hour before your death. And if you do it 2-4 before death, then it's going to be hard to know how to distribute the assets evenly because the value can possibly change. And what do you do with assets that you accrue after you make the gift? So theoretically, it's perfectly halakhically acceptable to divide your estate an hour before death. But no one is going to want to do this because if the estate is worth more than $26, because such a gift, at least in the United States, what do these gifts trigger? They trigger gift tax. So people are not going to want to give an hour before death to divide the estate, because then in such a case, one would be that would incur gift tax. Rabbi Kalman, would that incur gift tax by Canadian law? No estate taxes in Canada. Whoa, now what a country. Jake Kelman, Rabbi Kelman, are there any... Are there gift taxes? Are there gift taxes in Canada? No gift tax. Okay, there you go. So this idea of dividing states, so no gift tax. The United States there is. So in Canada it seems that you should would be an option to divide the assets an hour before death. But many people, it's just not just not practical. Many people are not mentally competent to be able to do that. There's only probate. Right, well, okay, probate, it makes sense. There has to be probate in any country. There has to be probate. You have to probate the will. Okay. The basic point is that in this year I wanted to get to deliver is that we make great efforts to live our lives in accordance with halakha, to make sure that our estate plan also is in harmony with halakha, and is done in a way which is smart, which is on a practical level, is halakhically acceptable, and you should have a will should be well carefully formulated in a way, well thought out, to avoid disturbances to shalom bayis. So Aubrey, Barbara, and Chuck, this would be included in the will when it's written. Oh. Would that be covered by a will? Because a will is supposed to be to bequeath. A will would seem to accomplish something only after death. But maybe if you have a document that would say that these distributions would take place an hour before death. Okay, it just may be hard to figure out unless you do this by percentage wise. What if you do on Shabbat? Okay. With the clothes making the debt if it is then done on Shabbat? Okay, it's a very good one, Judah. That's a good question. Rebbe Kiviger writes that there's an issur to make a kinyan on Shabbos. Now, not everybody agrees with Rebbe Kiviger, but you are tying together all the shiurim, right? That's really the question of keeping a website open on Shabbos. That's a huge issue. By the way, Rabbi Kalman, do you shut down Torah in Motion over Shabbos? Do you shut the website down? No, you don't shut it down. So that's an interesting issue. But that's a good issue. That basic issue of can you make a kinyan that will take effect on Shabbos. Right, that's a very, very big issue. Okay, but if you can divide assets within a lifetime, within a will, that by Canadian law, then that would be an excellent solution to the halakhic problem. The only thing is that I'm sorry? I'm not aware of anyone purchasing anything over Shabbat on our website, right? I hear you. In terms of the question that Aubrey and Barbara and Chuck asked, it would be hard to make sure that it's distributed evenly. In theory, they could. They have not. Okay. Got you. Maybe your daughter would be involved in Gezel if you would die on Shabbat. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay. Interesting point. Okay, I think we've completed. Rabbi Kalman, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you asked me to do this. This is a wonderful, wonderful experience. And Shalom, I wanted to thank you publicly for all the help that you gave me in teaching me how to work with Itim. We thank you very, very much, and thank all of you for participating. And it's been great.
If I may, I just want to thank you, publicly, Brother Chapter. And I see Glenn has a question. We'll get to your question in a moment, Glenn. I just want to thank you, and it was a pleasure on our end.
Yeah,
cool. And I'm sure we will at some future date continue this. And I just ask everybody, to spread the word. We're gonna, in general about E-Team, and that we're very happy to hear any ideas that anybody might have about speakers, anything that we're open to hearing ideas. So I want to thank you, Rabbi Jasper, for all the interesting classes, and thank all the people who are here. And I think Glenn has a question, and maybe anybody else. Okay, have a good night, everybody.
Bye. night. Glenn, go ahead.
Okay, you talked a lot about the daughter. Is there the same sort of issue for a Bechor? In other words, for the Bechor to do a Kinyan Sudar, contrasting your source 1 and source 6?
Right. Today, the Bechor does. Rabbi Shaftar recommended that everyone should get equal. Don't give the Bechor any more because it can cause severe disruption to Shalom Bayis. And the shtar that we spoke about, the modern analog to source number 9, would take care of the Bechor. The Bechor would basically inherit what he inherits, but he was motivated to gift over his extra share to the other sons and to the other, actually to all the other children. So he would not have to receive his double share in today's circumstances.
So halakhically he should, but you're getting around it through that shtar. Can you do it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically he inherits, and it means in theory he is inheriting, and truth is in practicality he is inheriting, but that money is, but he's, the shtar basically pressures him to gift the money to all the people named in the will, even those who are not halakhic heirs, even to non-Bechor or ordinary children, would be given an equal share along with the Bechor. So the Bechor would inherit, but he basically he's motivated to gift it over. That's the idea. Just the same way that I did with my sister, but I did that voluntarily. The shtar pretty much pressures the Bechor and the sons to give equal share to the other with the other children.
So in a family with only sons, there should be a separate document that says that this obligation to the non-Bechor sons, and that the Bechor, and in the secular document, that it is, how is it worded in the secular document?
Secular document, you word equal sharing. The secular document will take no cognizance of the halacha. The halachic issues are addressed by this little supplement that you can download from the RCA at rabbis.org.
Okay, so sorry, just to clarify the last point. In other words, pure secular, just the just normally distributed, and then the supplemental shtar, as you suggested, it could be downloaded, is to make the obligation from the Bechor to any other just general male children, correct?
Exactly, perfect. Right, 100%.
And this is a worthy discussion, just as your whole discussion about the daughter was an issue, because it deals with the same issue of getting around the halacha, because your source from number 6 shows clearly that the Torah says double portion for the Bechor. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. In today's circumstances, it has to be equal. Rav Shechter and other Rabbanim believe, not, I don't know about all of them, but in today's circumstances, it has to be equal. Just to quote you from Rav Shlomo Dechovsky, who is a dayan on the Beis HaNagadol on the Supreme Rabbinic Court of Appeals in Yerushalayim, he writes that he's adjudicated as a rabbinic judge in the Batei Din, the rabbinic courts in Israel. He has probated tens of thousands of wills, he writes, and not one of them did fail to provide an equal share with the daughters and the sons. So every one of them, he's the most pious of the biggest gedolei ador, they all provide an equal share with the daughters, and with the daughters and the wives. Hardly anyone today is observing these laws. I mean, we observe the laws of Bechor, but we really honor it in form and not in substance. Okay, but I think maybe when the Mashiach will come, we'll go back to the Torah system, but until then, we have to work with the share and share alike principle and just supplement that with the conditional obligation. I'm sorry, yes, Rabbi Kelman, can I ask a very difficult question on public policy? Yes, go ahead, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, in a sense, I'm playing here devil's advocate. I'm not sure. I agree with my question. I'm not sure. I don't agree. But here, Rav Schachter and many others are basically looking, we can't follow the laws of the Torah. That's a double pressure. We have to do whatever you want to call it. Harama, it is harama, it isn't harama, whatever we're doing, because we have to make the laws of the Torah sort of blend into our egalitarian pluralistic society. So I'm just sort of raising, why is there so much animosity towards women aliyot, which can be, I'm just saying, you can take many of these women's issues of today, which you know is the fault line of orthodoxy today, you know, women's issue is where they attack you the most. The liberals are beyond the pale. Why is it here in the evidence is this other question, and these other issues which are deemed to have been, and here we're dealing with the deemed to right up, very serious, and we kind of so easily, and deemed to have been on the political fighting and what goes on, I'm just curious for your input. I don't really have an answer. It's more a statement, and I want to hear your comments on that.
No, I don't necessarily have to. I won't decline, but it's good. That's a chesed, Ilana. Thanks for offering that. Now, you're raising a very important question. It's one that I've thought of, and many people have asked me that. This is the same Rav Schachter who's saying daughters have to get a full share, and the same Rabbi Willard who said to me the wives have to fully inherit the husband's estate. These same Rabbanim are the ones that are at the forefront against women's tefillah groups. But what's going on over here? So that's a very good question. It's an excellent question. I would say as follows, and that's a hard question. I was trying to dodge it, but Rabbi Kelman, you're great, and you always make sure that I don't dodge the hard question. So I'm going to try to answer it. I'm going to try to answer it as follows. This issue, we have a precedent for hundreds of years that Jews have been doing this. That Jews have used the Shtar HaTzizachar, and we're following their footsteps. So that's number one. And number two is that, I know you'll tell me that the answers are better than the questions, a lot better than the answers, but let's see if we can do it. So we're raising, that's number one, we have precedent. Number two, when it comes to money, number three, if I could dare speak for Rav Schachter and Rav Willig, they believe that, and I think really even the Haredi community believes, all of the Haredi, according to Rav Dichovsky's testimony, is that even within the Haredi community, there is a recognition today that the economics of the modern world demand that daughters have half a share in the wealth. And therefore, this is something that we will find the clever means in halacha to enable the daughters to receive a full share in the will. That's a far cry when it comes to ritual matters, which we have a lot less flexibility halachically speaking. That's number one. Number two is that, adopting egalitarianism within the ritual mode would severely disrupt Rav Schachter and Rav Willig believe the character of Jewish life, and would be an affront to the tradition that Jews have been, the way we've been living our lives for hundreds of years. So that's why it is a fault line. But Rabbi Schachter will say, you know, to you, I know for Canadians are very much into their hockey, but I think you have to keep it within the blue line, right? You have to keep it within the hockey. I haven't played hockey in a long time. It has to be within the proper bounds of the tradition, and the Shtar HaTzizachar is within the bounds of the tradition and does not constitute an affront to the tradition. Where, you know, to the basic character of Torah life, whereas adopting an egalitarian approach to tefillah and other ritual matters would be an affront to the halachic tradition. Okay, I try to answer that as best as I could. I know they always say the end of the question is better than the, not always, but in this case, the question is better than the answer, but.
Yeah, I'm not saying I disagree. I'm a Schechter, of course, is my worthy. I love a Schechter. I'm not even disagreeing. I'm just raising why, like, it was fine. That's what they feel, and I understand that. But the other upbringing, on the other side, will say there is precedent in the time of the Gemara that gave women aliyah. I mean, you can find precedent. We're dealing with our planet. I mean, you can answer Abba's point that even if you say you disagree, what bothers me, I guess, is the demons. I know it's often people, it's, this is more of an emotional issue, and people get all worked up. I'm just, like, pointing out, in a certain sense, there's an inconsistency in my mind on the vehemence of the opposition. While I fully understand it, I maybe even agree with it. I know I'm here, whereas I'm here, it's fine. I don't have an answer. I just, it bothers me, I guess, and I'm just raising it.
Yeah, I hear you. It's just, I think they consider, Rabbi Shatan will consider adopting feminist values into the halacha, and even find clever ways to adopt it within the halacha would be an affront to the basic character of the halacha and really an halachic life. That's why I think they're so vehemently against it, even though it's it's inconsistent. Rav Judah is saying, right, that's why Rav Soloveitchik fought so hard at Machitzas. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik fought so hard at Machitzas, and yet he also fought that girls should be able to learn Gemara. You know, that's, sometimes there's room for egalitarianism, and sometimes there is not. By the way, I have actually another, actually it just occurred to me, Rabbi Kelman, one other way to answer that is that I think you even have a precedent in Tanakh. It is halachic judgment. I like that. It's halachic judgment because you're trying to preserve our culture and then just the character of our culture. I would say something else. In terms of Yerusha, I believe there's a precedent in Tanakh that women receive a full share in the will. And that is, look in Sefer Rut. The field of Elimelech is referred to as the field of Naomi. It's her field. Now, she's not a halachic heir, yet it's considered to her field. Apparently, even in the time of Tanakh, Zod Lifnim v'Yisrael, the daughters would be receiving at least part of a share in the will, and here we have Naomi's being described as inheriting her husband's estate, even though halachically she's not the heir. Maybe the halachic heirs gifted that field to Naomi. This is a very interesting point. So in terms of flexibility, in terms of the laws of Yerusha, there's a lot more flexibility, and we do have strong precedents in the Tanakh for such flexibility. And one could argue that you don't have such flexibility when it comes to aliyahs for the Torah or women's tefillah groups. Okay.
Your question
is better than my answer.
It's a difficult public policy issue, and I understand our gazelling have to make judgments, and it's just, I guess it hurts me, all the machloket on these issues, and, you know, that even many people who disagree, I'm putting this on the telepathic level, understand that people who have views that, let's say even women are New York, that I'm not comfortable with, of course, but, you know, I can understand where someone is coming from. They're not going to yell and scream at them like they're not swim, I think I hope not, because of that. I'm just, that's all. I don't have an answer. I'm just raising it as like I said, a difficult public policy issue. Understanding the refining have to, as Ilana says, make those halakhic judgments.
Right. Yelling and screaming is never or hardly ever a good option.
We're calling it a good note.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rav Judah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much, Glenn, Norby, Barbara. Thank you, Ben Chuck. Chakasha Sameach, Chakasha Sameach to you all.